Welcome to the Sports Ethics Podcast. The Sports Ethics Podcast discusses the many ethical and philosophical issues that arise in and around sport. I am Sean Klein, the sports ethicist. You can read the Sports Ethicist blog at sportsethicist.com, where you can also download podcasts of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, or find links to related information. The Sports Ethicist is also on Facebook and on Twitter at Sports Ethicist, and you can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. Today is January 9th, 2015. My guest today is Aaron Flynn. Aaron Flynn is an associate professor of philosophy at Ohio Wesleyan University, specializing in 19th century German philosophy. Hegel, I believe, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, big Hegel guy. For some reason, I don't know why, but he's particularly interested in questions regarding freedom, responsibility, and the nature and justification of punishment, as well as in the intersection of philosophy and popular culture, especially movies and sport. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
I also feel compelled to mention that as mutual Red Sox fans, that you also contributed an article to Red Sox and Philosophy, an article called Blurst, where you try to make sense out of the Nelson Goodman discussion of GRU and apply that to the curse of the Bambino. So it's a fun article to read. I reread it in the last day or two just to see if there was anything that I wanted to bring up today. But feel as Red Sox fans, I feel we have to stick together on that front. So
I think absolutely.
Our topic today, though, is your paper on the Suarez handball, which deals with the ethics of strategic fouls. So this is a paper that you've presented a couple times, once at the International Association for Philosophy of Sport, and then before that at the symposium that I have here at Radford University back in 2002. So it's fun to see how this paper has developed and grown. And so I'm really looking forward to talking about the issues in it. So I was hoping first we could talk a little bit just about what a strategic foul is and why it's of interest to sports ethicists. So what's your take on strategic fouls? What are they?
So as I understand a strategic foul, it's an intentional foul that is committed in order to enhance one's competitive position in an athletic contest. So these can range from the relatively commonplace and mundane. You think, for instance, of fouls at the end of a basketball game. So a team may intentionally foul the team that's in the lead in order to force them to shoot free throws in hopes that they might miss free throws, or perhaps in order to secure more chances at three-point baskets. And so you're intentionally committing a foul, but you're trying to enhance your competitive position. And of course, they can range to the more extreme sorts of versions. I suppose, for instance, a badly beaten defensive back on a football field may just intentionally reach out and grab a wide receiver, take the pass interference penalty instead of giving up what could well be a touchdown. So as I understand a strategic foul, it's simply any such foul that's done intentionally in order to enhance or to protect competitive position. Now, I think that sports ethicists are interested in strategic fouls, often find strategic fouls problematic simply because they threaten to or they seem to undermine the athletic contest as a comparative test of athletic skill. That is to say, if an athletic contest is defined as such a comparative test, the relevant athletic skills in question seem not to include violating the rules that constitute the contest. And so the worry, I think the main worry about strategic fouls is that using a strategic foul to enhance your competitive position is to circumvent or to undermine again, the contest as a comparative.
So, I mean, one other way that I think it's interesting to ethicists is because in a lot of ways, that description sounds a lot like what we would talk about when people talk about cheating, right? You're violating a rule, you're doing it intentionally, you're doing it to gain an advantage in the game. That seems like that there's a lot of surface similarities between that and just conventional cheating. And that's, I think, something that draws our attention to it, because we want to be able to, intuitively, we draw a distinction between that. People know that when you foul Kobe Bryant or something, that that's not, you're not cheating, right? But you are violating a rule of the game. You're doing so intentionally, and you're doing so to attempt to stay in the game or get back in the game, to gain some advantage in the game. And so it has a superficial similarity to cheating that we want to try to distinguish between these intentional rule violations. Whether or not we find them acceptable is a further evaluation. And it seems like in the way that you described it, there's a spectrum of ones that, and I know when I talk about with my students, things like the basketball foul, they're sort of shocked that you would even bring that up as a discussion point of what could possibly be wrong with these. But then, as you said, you know, you have questions about whether or not, you know, an intentional pass interference, committing pass interference to prevent the touchdown, or as one of the things we'll talk about today, using a handball in soccer, either to defend a goal, or in the case of Maradona, right, to score a goal, is, you know, that those seem a little bit more controversial, but it's this comparison to cheating that I think is another way, in addition to the concerns, for the same reasons that we're concerned about cheating, of course, some we're concerned about intentional rule violations because of what they might do to the game in terms of undermining the value of the contest. So they have these similarities, except I think a lot, at least the non-sport philosopher who is interested in talking about these often there's a category of these that they just intuitively think these are okay. Some of these are acceptable.
Right.
And I think there's a number of sport philosophers too, who want to try to make a case for some domain of an acceptable strategic foul. Even the harshest critics, someone like Frawley, seems to at least want to make, some space for some. His space is much smaller, as far as I can tell, than others. But there's still at least some space for an intentional rule violation that could be acceptable. So I guess what would be your first blush distinguishing factor between something like just what we might conventionally call cheating and an intentional rule violation or a strategic intentional rule violation? Why would those be? Why do we have different categories for those?
Well, that's a very difficult question, I think. I mean, let me say one thing right off the bat. So I agree with you. Of course, the casual, not the casual, the sports fan who's not a philosopher of sport, I think will be startled to hear that the philosopher of sport thinks that there's something potentially problematic about fouling at the end of a basketball game to extend that will seem very puzzling, I think, to most basketball fans. And I do think that the philosopher of sport should take the intuitions of that basketball fan seriously.
Yeah.
So I'm you know, one, philosophers do this, I think, generally with ethics, and there's it's an open question how much we actually share intuitions and whether those intuitions should carry some philosophical weight. My own view is that we should take those intuitions seriously and then subject them to some kind of rational scrutiny. But let me say this also, though I think, for instance, the basketball fan will be surprised to hear philosophers of sport, ethicists, raise questions about those late game fouls, I think that novice fans will often be watching a sport such as basketball, and they'll see a player commit an intentional foul in that circumstance, and they'll turn to the more sort of seasoned fan and they'll say, "What was that?"
Right.
It will strike them as just utterly wrong-headed and in fact quite close to cheating. And so one might well say of the fans' nonchalance with respect to those strategic fouls, that may just be the fact that the fan is somehow by now inured to what really should raise eyebrows and trouble them. Now, that's not to answer your question. What, if anything, is the difference between the intentional foul and cheating? I don't have a systematic answer to that. I mean, I think that you might say, for instance, that the intentional foul is typically done out in the open. In fact, in order for many intentional fouls to work, or strategic fouls to work, they have to be observed. They have to be recognized by the referee, for instance. Otherwise, they're not going to do the job
that
the player wants them to do. And many instances of cheating are secretive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They need not to be discovered. But I think that we, without too much difficulty, we could find instances that we think are cheating, but maybe are openly done, done in such circumstances that they actually can't be punished, for instance, for whatever reason, they can be done with impunity. So I guess I don't have a set of criteria to distinguish the intentional foul mm-hmm. from cheating. I think for some theorists, they really deserve to be discussed together and maybe stand and fall together. For other theorists, they seem to be very different things, but I will confess I haven't given a lot of thought to figuring out exactly how to distinguish the two. I would be interested in your thoughts if you think there's a rough and ready dividing line between the two.
I don't, and that's partly why I was hoping maybe you did. But I mean, I think you do hit on one distinguishing factor. I don't think it's universal, but the deceptive factor, the trying to get away with factor of the cheat does seem different than the intentional rule violator or the strategic fouler. In one respect, because it's completely useless, as you said, to commit a strategic foul if you're not going to get caught. I mean, the whole point of the basketball foul is to get caught. You don't do it on the sly, otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Right.
It's not effective. Now I think there are borderline cases, but I think further down the spectrum there are going to be sort of certain scenarios, certain cases where the strategic fouler is engaging in the foul, but if they get caught, fine. They understand that they sort of took a risk. They accept that. But at the same time, if they don't get caught and they gain an advantage through commission of the foul, that's fine too. But they don't necessarily are deceptive about it. So I think something like the pass interference call that we were talking about.
Precisely.
You know, if the defender, you know, the corner gets flagged, they understand why. They accept it that, yeah, I got burnt and that's all I could do was just reach out and grab the face mask or something like that, or just knock him down. That's the only thing I could do is to trip him while he's on the way to the ball, that there was nothing else I could do. And I'd rather take the penalty. If it just goes uncalled, right? Like if you're the Lions and Cowboys, I guess,
right.
then it
No, that actually went called and then uncalled.
Right. No, yeah. Right. It wasn't precisely the case. But, you know, you're happy to have gotten away with it as well, because right. The same end. So that becomes a little bit different of a case but I think another aspect with a lot of cheating in sport is stuff that happens off the field. Right. So you talk about performance enhancing drugs or other sort of preparation cheats or using equipment that's not appropriate. Things on the field that you might adjust in order for your team's advantage against some set of rules. So they're sort of external to the actual play. I think is a lot of times cases of cheating. Another concern. Were you going to say something? Sorry.
No. I was. Oh. I'm sorry. I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay. And then, I mean, when we start dealing with ordinary language like this, it's so fuzzy, right? Cheating, what's a cheat is very ambiguous of a term. And so I think to try to come up with a precise set of distinguishing characteristics between the strategic foul and cheating, I think is probably unwise, because they're just not at the same level of description, because strategic foul in some ways is a more technical term. It's not really a technical term, but it is something that is more artificial in the sense that we've kind of named we've picked out certain kinds of activities and named them, whereas cheating seems to be something that we look for already. We have this sort of concept, and then we look for examples of it. So I think it's a little bit, it's a different kind of animal. And so to try to compare them, I think, gets us into trouble. And, you know, one thing I sometimes talk about when we talk about this in class is, you know, it's presupposed that cheating involves rule violation. And so maybe there's a way in which intentional rule violations is the generic category and cheating is one subcategory, and then strategic fouls or professional fouls is another. But I start wondering, well, I wonder if that's true. I mean, and I haven't really come up with a good example, but is there a way that you can cheat while still not sort of intentionally violating the rules? My sense is we could probably, there's something out there that might fit that category. And it gets a little, I think, off the focus here of your paper. But does that make sense what I'm saying in terms of cheating, even though you're still abiding by the rules in a way? Maybe it's just gamemanship or something. So it's not. Do you see the kind of category I'm looking for?
I do. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of a very clear or obvious example. But I sense that you're probably right. And you mentioned gamesmanship. I do think that some people's intuitions would say that, I threaten your family.
Okay,
while
yeah.
We're on the field, right? There's no rule against that. But suppose that for whatever reason, I'm the kind of person where that threat is credible, right? And you're looking at me suddenly like, this psycho's serious about that. Now, I haven't violated a rule, but I think many of us would say I've done something wrong, and maybe it's properly described as a kind of cheating. Now, probably what I've done there is a more serious moral wrong than your run-of-the-mill cheating, but it may also count as an instance of cheating.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, because you are trying to gain an advantage and change the outcome of the game. You're not violating a rule of the game. You might be violating rules of society, but you're not violating the rules of the game per se. And so, if depending on how you want to define cheating, that might be a case of a non-rule violation form of cheating. But then depending on how you want to deal with gamemanship and other cases of bad sportsmanship, those might fit in there. Jack Bowen, or Bowen, is a sports ethicist in Santa Clara, and he recently put up an article about icing the kicker, and as a case of bad sportsmanship. And so it doesn't violate a rule, but are you unfairly gaining an advantage in the contest by engaging in that kind of behavior? And so that sort of broadly fits into this discussion of strategic fouls or using the rules to your advantage in ways that they weren't necessarily intended.
Yeah, it certainly does. It certainly does. Yeah, I think that kind of example might bear on some of what I say in my paper. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Good. And so your paper uses as a kind of a frame the case of Suarez's Luis Suarez's handball in the 2010 World Cup.
That's right. Yeah, the quarterfinals. Yep.
Yeah. So why don't you describe that scenario? What happened in this game?
So it's a quarterfinal match. Uruguay is playing Ghana. Ghana is the only African team left, and I mention that only because the World Cup was played in South Africa, first time it's ever been played in Africa, and I think a lot of observers, serious soccer fans, casual soccer fans, they were hoping that an African nation would have a good performance in the World Cup. And by and large, in 2010, the African nations had disappointed, with the exception of Ghana. They had played an excellent World Cup. They were going in, I think it would be fair to say, as an underdog to Uruguay in that quarterfinal match. The match was level in extra time and very, very near to the expiration of extra time. So if it ends, obviously, in a tie, they go to penalty kicks to decide the game. Ghana gets a shot on goal. There's a bit of a scramble in front of the goal, and indeed Luis Suarez, who's a striker, but he's back defending because I believe they had a corner kick shortly beforehand or a free kick. Luis Suarez actually made a tremendous foot save. The ball comes up, and Asamoah Gyan, I think it was Gyan, got a header on goal. Suarez, from the video, it appeared that he really had no option, maybe I shouldn't describe it this way, but he had no option other than to throw his hands up to the, up above his shoulder to the right of his head to swat the ball away with his hands. And he did so. He stopped the goal from going in. Video replay showed that it was certain to be a goal and therefore almost certain to be a victory for Ghana.
All right.
He stops the ball with his hands. This is, as I'm sure you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, this is about as serious an infraction as you can have on a soccer field, you know, short of attempting to injure your opponents.
Yes. Such as biting your opponent.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. We can maybe get into Suarez's character a bit as well. But this is a very serious infraction. It's an automatic red card, which means, you know, you're sent off. Even if Uruguay advances, Suarez would be automatically suspended for the next game, the semifinal match. And the penalty, in addition to the red card and being sent off, is a free kick for Ghana, a penalty kick, I should say, for Ghana. They received the penalty kick. Their star player, Asamoah Gyan, takes the penalty kick and unfortunately misses the PK.
Doesn't he hit the crossbar?
I think he hit the crossbar. You know, statistics vary, but I think that a fair estimate at that level, penalty kicks are made maybe 3 out of 4 times, about 75% of the time.
That's the statistic that I'm familiar with, about 70-75%. Yeah.
And so he misses it. Uruguay survives that scare. They go on to actually win in penalties. And so Ghana is eliminated. So that's the Suarez handball in question. Maybe in more detail than you wanted, but
no, that's good. I think the detail is important for a lot of the discussion of the case and on whether or not how much weight we want to give to the specifics of it. But I think in terms of trying to figure out the fairness of it, because, you know, in one sense, right, it certainly sounds like Ghana was robbed, right? Because they certainly would have won, right? I mean, I think that the time was really about to expire, right? And you're in the 120th minute, so I think they were just about out of time anyway. And so Suarez being sent off, it affects the next game, but it really doesn't give them any advantage in the penalty kick, and then in the penalty kicks to decide the game. So in that way, the punishment seems less severe than it would be had it been in the 80th minute or some similar sort of amount of time, even the 115th minute, right, where Ghana could have used that man advantage to score.
That's right.
And so I think that's important to sort of get that detail, because that might factor into how we might evaluate the overall fairness of it. Now, as an American or as a U.S. fan watching the game, of course, I think we were kind of rooting for Uruguay because Ghana had knocked us out in a way that, if I remember correctly, the USA was sort of robbed, that we should have had a call on the baseline for that would have gone against Ghana. I forget the exact situation. I don't know if you remember.
I confess, I don't remember.
And I could be confusing situations. But I think the previous game was Ghana and US. And I think there was a call that should have been made that wasn't made against Ghana. So there was, I think at the time, I remember watching it, and I remember kind of feeling a sort of Schadenfreude, or sort of karma coming around with it. And then also another aspect, sort of just personally, is since that time I've also become something of a Liverpool supporter. And of course, last year Suarez was a tremendous player for Liverpool. And so it wasn't until sort of halfway through the season that I even made the connection between these two. It turned out to be the same person.
Right, that's Suarez, yeah.
Yeah, like, oh, right, Suarez from this famous case that I actually use in class all the time. Yeah. And because I do show this video in class as part of the introduction for the unit that we do on strategic fouls, because I think it is, I think it brings out so much of what's at issue here, because you have the intentionality aspect of it, like you said. Doesn't really see there, not that he doesn't necessarily have a choice, because he does have a choice not to commit the handball.
True.
But if he doesn't commit the handball, Ghana wins.
That's right.
You know, and if he does commit it, there's really only 30% chance that roughly that Ghana's not going to win. All right. Right. I guess another way to say it, right, there's a 70% chance that Ghana's going to get that penalty kick and win the game because time will expire.
Yeah.
And
thinking strictly in terms of cost benefit, I think that everyone has to agree from a standpoint of effectiveness, he made the right play.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think that there, if you're only thinking in terms of cost benefit of effectiveness, it was a good play. It was a successful play.
Yeah. Yeah, and more successful, I think, anyone would have imagined at that particular moment. And because Ghana, I think, also is had a reputation, I think. I'm getting a little out of my comfort zone here, but I think he had a reputation of being a pretty good penalty kicker, too. So it was his statistics, it might even been more of a chance that he would have gotten that penalty kick. But that I could be wrong on that.
Maybe. You know, you may know in a In an old article called "The Decline of Cause," Judith Jarvis Thompson is talking about this. I think it's a 1948 California case in which two hunters. There's a trio of hunters out, and two hunters fire in the direction of the third hunter, and one of them actually strikes the third hunter. The third hunter can't determine which of the two actually struck him, and in traditional tort law, this is a problem because that means he can't establish cause for either one of his two fellow hunters, and so he argues that he should be allowed to sue each of them individually, even though he can't establish that either one in fact caused his injuries, and he won his case. In any event, I mention all of this because
it's interesting.
Judith Jarvis Thompson says this really is a wonderful case. If it hadn't happened in reality, philosophers should have to have invented it.
Right.
And I feel that way a little bit about the Suarez handball. It's just about every particular detail of the case fits perfectly to create the kind of dilemma that we sometimes strive to create in hypotheticals.
Yeah, we have this conflict between, particularly that you try to draw out in your paper, between the goal of playing to win versus playing, under the obligation to abide by the rules of the game, and so you have that sort of conflict there that gets brought out, the heightened aspect of the game because it's a World Cup, and so you call. It brings that into because then we can also say, okay, well, what if this was just a youth league game, you know, down at the Y or something like that, you know? And I try to vary that when we talk about it in the class too, because some students say, oh, it's the World Cup, of course you do this, right? Just from the practical standpoint. Okay, well, now let's change the scenario, and it's not a World Cup game, but it's just this sort of friendly match, you know, and just to try to look, okay, do we look at it differently that way? Some might not, but and some of my athletes in the class often don't, but some of the others do, right? They kind of, well, they're just sort of always competitive, right? So it's sort of always on, whereas others do sense that there is a difference there between this sort of friendly game or youth league game or high school game or something like that, where the stakes are less high, and then to try to figure out, okay, well, why do the stakes matter? How does that evaluate what we're doing here? All right, if it's, cheating seems to be wrong one way or the other. And if this is a case of cheating, why should it matter what the stakes are? But so it calls into to relief these different aspects of just our judgment of the rightness or the wrongness, the blameworthiness of these sorts of situations. So that, yeah, it's a great case, and it's a really interesting one, and all the more better that it's a real one.
That's right.
You know, another interesting thing that often doesn't get brought up is when you watch the video, there's another, I don't know who it is, but there's another Uruguayan in the goal with Suarez who mm-hmm. essentially is trying to do the same thing as Suarez. He just doesn't do it, right? Because Suarez is there. And so it does. I don't know what that means. I think it suggests, at least in some ways, that this, not that this is something that anybody would have done in the same situation, but it lends some credence to the idea that most of the people on the field of play in the same situation would have done that as well. All right. I think it lends some suggestion to that. And I don't know how important that is, but it does seem to be something that we have to include in the discussion. How do you read that?
I agree. I think that, well, as your anecdotal evidence from your class suggests, my recollection is that other players, I can't remember reading specific responses from the Ghanaian players, but my general recollection is that Suarez didn't come in for a lot of criticism from other professional players. The criticism that he received was maybe from official bodies, but definitely from some subset of soccer fans. Now maybe you correct me on that. Maybe there were other professionals who were saying, "What are you doing? That's no way for a professional to behave." But that's not my recollection.
Yeah, I share the same view of the response. I think that it was mixed. There was some outcry, though the outcry seemed to be more from the sort of general audience and fans, which is, then it's hard to read how much of it is because they're fans of one team or another or player or another, as right. opposed to trying to objectively evaluate the situation. The professional players didn't seem to comment on it too much, which is kind of par for the course for professional players anyway, right?
I don't think that they hesitated to comment on his biting incidences.
This is true. That's a good contrast. Yeah. So I think that this was something that I think a lot of players probably realized, yeah, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I will add that one of the reasons that I got interested in writing this paper way back when, and it was not too long after the foul was committed. This paper kind of got me into philosophy of sport, which is a region of philosophy that I've long been interested in, but I really had no experience in reading, and certainly not in attempting to write in this area. But the response to the Suarez case struck me as bifurcated along two equally implausible lines. One was the line that said, "This is clearly wrong. What he did is utterly inexcusable. It is effectively cheating." And I thought, that doesn't seem right to me. I'm not sure I know why it's wrong, but my intuition said, I don't buy it. But then on the other end of the spectrum, it seemed that defenders would often say things along the following lines. And I'm just talking about the popular response, not the philosophers of sport. The defenders would say something like, "Ethics don't have any place in sports." Uh-huh. You know, it's just, if you can do it and get away with it, or if you can do it and it helps you to win, that's what you do. And I thought, even from my perspective as a competitor, you know, someone who watches athletics but also plays sports, I thought, no, that doesn't seem right either. And so I was just dissatisfied with these two, what seemed to me to be the two predominant popular responses. And so I just wanted to try to think through it a little bit and to say, if I think that what he did was either not wrong or was excusable, why do I think that? And am I justified in thinking that?
All right. So that's a good segue. why do you think that?
Well, so in a nutshell, I suppose, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier on. I suggest in the paper that that competitive athletes have what I call a practical obligation to play to win. And when I call that a practical obligation because I don't think it's an ethical or a moral obligation. I think that it is it's a requirement of actually playing the game that they're playing. In other words, unless you're playing to win, you're not really playing the game in the context of an athletic contest. And in light of that that practical obligation to play to win, I don't think that anything goes. I think that players also have, in some broad sense, I'm willing to accept that players have what I guess I'm willing to also to call an ethical obligation to conform their conduct to the rules in as much as they can, right? Mm-hmm. And so then the question that I wanted to raise about these situations of strategic fouls or intentional fouls is, what happens if those two obligations come into conflict with each other? What happens if you can't truly play to win the game while also attempting to conform your conduct as best you can to the rules? Should one say that you always have an obligation, and is it something like a perfect duty to simply, you know, sacrifice playing to win in order to play within the rules? And I think not. I think that where there is a conflict, we may have, under certain conditions, reason at the very least to excuse intentional violations of the rules, because it is unreasonable of us to expect competitors to sacrifice a ground project or an identity-defining project, in this case, the project of playing to win, in order to conform their conduct to an ethical or a moral rule. So in a nutshell, that's the reason why I think that Suarez's case, why Suarez, that particular instance, is excusable. Whether or not it's justified is another question, and I don't really take that up in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's always an interesting distinction. You know, the making an excuse or providing an excuse for behavior versus justifying, something that I think non-philosophers often kind of elide that distinction, right? They get confused between excusing a behavior and thinking that you're justifying it or vice versa. Because if you're justifying an activity, there is no excuse to be made, right? You're not making an excuse. You did the right thing. An excuse presupposes already that you've done something wrong, something inappropriate. And so now we're looking for some sort of mitigating reason or some set of reasons to see why you're not fully blameworthy. You're not fully on the hook, as I think Austin would say in that front.
And let me jump in here, because I think I agree with you that non-philosophers might scuttle the difference if they're called upon to talk about the difference.
Yeah.
But I actually think in practice, non-philosophers do a perfect job of understanding the difference very well.
Okay.
So that in our interpersonal lives, if you do something that is not justified but is excusable to another, I think most of us will see and act on the difference between saying what I did was right versus I'm sorry that happened. I know that was wrong, but these are the reasons you shouldn't hold me responsible for it. You know, it's the difference between saying, you know, it's the difference, for instance, between saying there's nothing wrong with, I don't know, the fact that I went out and slept with someone else because you and I had a previous agreement that this was okay, versus saying, I know I shouldn't have gone out and slept with that other person, but I was in, you know, the throes of despair, or I literally didn't know what I was doing. Or I'm not saying those would always or should always work as excuses, but I think in practice, uh-huh, we actually do we do respect those the difference between excuses and justifications, which is also not to say that there's a hard and fast line and that there'll never be borderline cases.
Right.
But I guess my own view is that is that in practice we do, there is a distinction to be made, and it's exactly that distinction that enables philosophers to draw it out in more conceptually precise terms.
Oh, absolutely. I hope I didn't, I'm sorry if I implied otherwise, right?
You probably didn't, but I did want to, I think that you're right that when we're called upon to talk about the difference, we can easily become confused.
Yeah.
But in practice, I think the difference operates, you know, I think most of us see it, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, I think a lot of philosophy talk is like that it's, you know, like I think it was Augustine who said he knows what time is until he tries to think about what it is. Exactly. You know, and I think it was, Iris Murdoch, who said philosophy is I'm gonna have to paraphrase it because there's no way I'll get the quote exactly right, but something along the lines of philosophy is finding a way to state the simple thing in some way, right? To take the simple idea, the clear, obvious idea, and state it right in a way, and that's actually really hard to do.
Yeah.
And so we feel around a lot, and we can make our way through the world quite well that way. And then when we try to think about it to improve the process, it actually we realize just how hard it is. And that's not a really an uncommon thing. I mean, most people know how to ride a bike, but if you try to explain that, it's like, wow, actually this is pretty difficult.
That's right.
You know,
well, you can also, you know, just a more contemporary example, you can think of, you know, Brandom's massive work, Making It Explicit. I take it that's, again, that's in the spirit of the title of that work, taking what is implicitly rational, the implicit reasons that govern our practice, and making those explicit.
Yeah. So back to strategic foul. So I really... found this part of your paper really interesting because I think it brings out a number of things, both in terms of the discussion of strategic fouls, but I think also just generically for thinking about moral philosophy or ethical philosophy more generically. You know, one, of course, you have this discussion about the practical versus the moral, which coming from a more, I guess, broadly Aristotelian view, I don't necessarily distinguish those as hard and fast as some more contemporary philosophic approaches do, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, you know, I think in some ways in your discussion, you're trying to talk to those more contemporary people who want a hard and fast distinction between the practical and moral. But I think those are more intimately connected, which doesn't take away from your point that there still can be a conflict between two different kinds of obligations that we take on, or that there's two courses of activities that we're committed to that might bump into each other. So having this commitment to play to win, because that's you know what it is to be playing in an athletic contest, is to be playing to win, but that's going to run into conflict with also this obligation to conform your play to the rules of the game, which is also part and parcel of what it is to be playing in that contest. So that's what makes this issue so fruitful and so interesting, is because that conflict is there. How, you know, if we want to put it as practical versus moral or between just two conflicting sort of obligations, it's still an interesting conflict or paradox that comes up.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I certainly did not mean in drawing the distinction between a practical obligation and a moral or an ethical obligation. I didn't mean to, you might say, reinscribe some absolute or hard and fast divide.
Sure.
Between the moral and the non-moral. I tend to be inclined toward the view you just described, the Aristotelian view, which sees perhaps the moral and the ethical as part of a broader category of the practical.
Uh-huh.
So I think you hit it exactly right, that I'm speaking to people who I think maybe would be more insistent upon the distinction, and what's more, who tend to regard the moral and the ethical dimension of the practical as somehow the highest domain of the
right.
practical. or that to which all other practical domains must be subordinate if one is to remain a moral or ethical person. And as I tried to say in the paper, I think that you can be a morally or ethically reasonable person without thinking that moral reasons always trump other practical obligations.
Yeah, and I think that's another aspect of this section that I really liked was pointing out that the just for keeping with your language, right, the practical value, the practical duty or obligation that one has isn't always trumped by the moral one. That these, you know, oftentimes they are, right? But that even in all things considered situations, that it's not an automatic thing that the moral somehow is imbued with this sort of special trump card always there. That once you bring out the moral, boom, it trumps everything else. And I think that's an important aspect to include in our discussions, not just of strategic fouls, but of broadly lots of ethical situations. And Philippa Foot in Natural Goodness also draws this out quite a bit in trying to show that these other sort of things that we might consider as practical obligations, that they can sometimes actually trump over the moral ones, and that's important to recognize because they're part of what it is. They're part of the human enterprise. They're part of how it is that humans ought to be behaving in the world. Some we might divide it up in different ways in terms of moral or practical or whatever, but that these are all aspects that we ought to be paying attention to when we're thinking about how we're going to act and so I like that you're bringing that out in terms of the strategic value discussion. Obviously, you want it to be in harmony, right? And right. try to work to achieve that, but circumstances don't always allow that. And this is where practical judgment or phrenesis or practical wisdom, however you want to refer to that, comes into play in trying to figure out how to balance this out, given one's ends and given the context, given the particulars of the situation, and then making the best decision about which set of obligations or commitments are the ones that you ought to be putting at the top of the hierarchy, so to speak, for taking one's action. So I think that's something that adds value to the discussion about strategic values. So I think that's really a fruitful avenue to talk about.
I appreciate that.
Now, another way to talk about this too is instead of trying to characterize Suarez's action as right or wrong or blameworthy or excusable or even praiseworthy or justifiable, is to also to think about it in terms of, I guess, keeping on with this virtue ethical sort of approach, is as honorable or dishonorable. And because there is a sense that even though I think that I'm willing to buy into what am I trying to say? I'm not quite sure he's justified. I think you and I are on the same page. I don't think he's in the wrong, or at least in the strong sense, right? That he in some ways is excused for what he has done here.
Right.
But I'm not entirely unwilling to say that there's a case to be made for it to be justified.
Yeah.
In any case, even if it's justified, I'm not sure it's the most honorable action. Do you see what I mean?
Like, yes, I do.
Like when I think about, okay, well, how do I want the game to be played at its best? What would I want to do? What would I coach my son to do in that situation? What would I want him to do and be most proud of if he had done? And I'm not sure that this is what I would want him to do. I'm not saying definitively it's not either. I'm still not sure on that. I think that's what makes this case, I think, so rich, is because I don't think the answers are obvious. But it does strike me as something to worry about. That doesn't seem like it's, at least at first blush, it doesn't look like the honorable action to take.
Yeah. Yeah, in one way, in my paper, I sort of took the, I don't know if I want to say I took the easy way out. I did not try to to justify
right.
what he had done. And I was willing to, for the sake of argument, to say that what he did was not justified. And then to ask, nevertheless, ought he to be blamed for it? Should we hold this against him? I'm with you. I have my doubts about whether or not we could give a justification for his action, at least given other sort of presuppositions that I have. One of which is that, broadly speaking, I think competitors do have an ethical obligation to conform their conduct to the rules, to play by the rules, to attempt to win within the parameters that the rules set. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the most succinct way of getting at that intuition for me is to say, I have a real hard time not thinking that Ghana was robbed.
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm willing to say Ghana was wronged, Ghana was robbed, then it starts to look very odd. They were wronged, but the one person who wronged them didn't actually wrong them. And so what is one to make of that? So that leads me to have some doubts about whether or not the play could be justified. If it's not justified, that gets maybe quite quickly to at least one way of answering your question about whether or not what he did was the most honorable course of action, because then, of course, it wasn't the most honorable course of action. It was wrong. Mm-hmm. The way I think I put it in the paper, or at least occasionally in the paper, was that, you know, there would have been, I think many of us would have admired him had he kept his hands to himself, especially if we had realized that, you know, he could have swatted that away with his hands and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I
bet there would have been outcry that he didn't. Not outcry might be too strong, but I bet there would have been people who said, you know, he could have stopped it if he put his hands up. Yeah, it would have been a red card, but you know, that's what he should have done.
I've thought about exactly that, and I've thought about myself as one of his teammates. Mm-hmm. Would I have held it against him? Would I have said, look, you know, it was on you to stop that goal. In that way, I will admit, my intuition is simply not entirely firm.
Yeah.
One of the ways that I talk about it in the paper, and I'm not sure how useful this is, but I talk about, for instance, I mean, you speak in terms of virtues. You can imagine the way a saintly player might play the game. And then I think you can ask the question whether or not, well, we know saints don't usually play the game. and maybe you can also ask the question whether or not saints could be good players of the game. I mean, do you see what I'm driving at?
Right.
There?
Yeah. Like that sort of gets at that conflict that you're talking about, is that, is this, how fundamental of a conflict is it? Is it something that arises occasionally between the obligation to play to win and versus the obligation to play in conformity with the rules? Is something that happens more, occasionally on certain rather contrived situations or specific circumstances, or is it more generic throughout the whole of the game?
Right.
And that raises some interesting questions about the moral value of sport in general.
It's true, but I guess one perhaps question to raise is, look, for the person who's concerned with honor in what I think is maybe the sense in which you meant honor before, for the person who's concerned with honor in the ethical sense, can that person take seriously enough duties of so practical obligation to play to win, right? So it might be that if your concern is with ethical or moral uprightness, ethical or moral honor, and maybe you mean honor in a, given the things you said earlier, maybe you mean honor in a broader sense. But for the person whose concern is with moral honor in that sense, perhaps they cannot really be good competitors. And I mean good in some fairly robust sense there. I don't mean merely effective competitors. I mean that they will exhibit certain deficiencies when it comes to playing to win. In other words, we might say, I don't really want those types on my team. If you follow right. me. And not
I do.
Because, and not just because I want effective players. Now, maybe the right response there is to say, no, we need a conception of honor that fits the contours of competitive athletics. So we don't want to incorporate that. So when I speak of the saint playing, I'm muddling categories there, right? I'm trying to bring Mother Teresa into the domain of competitive athletics. And you might respond by saying, no, we need a conception of honor that is localized to that particular enterprise, in this case, the enterprise of competitive athletics. And even there, you might be saying to me, I'm not sure that Suarez, well, we know Suarez doesn't fit the bill
right.
generally, but I'm not sure Suarez fits the bill in this particular instance. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I raised the issue of honor, so you'd think I would have an answer. But yeah, I don't want to go so far. Well, I guess one way would be to even get at the framing of the question in terms of talking about saintliness and whether that's an appropriate standard to even use.
Sure.
In any context of ethical discussion, right? You know, particularly if you're thinking of it in a particular sort of context of a particular sort of saint, like. Use the example of Mother Teresa, although she wouldn't be my example. But I think, now I have this image of her playing soccer, so running through my head. So that's kind of...
Then I did my job.
Yeah. So I am tempted to say, yeah, that the conception of honorable or noble, I think, would be something that would be compatible with playing well. Now, whether that really works out or not is definitely something worth thinking hard about. But I my sense is that ultimately we can flesh that out, and that there is that playing to win has a certain kind of moral value. I would say moral value in that broad sense of moral. That is, as you said, independent of just playing skillfully or playing well as well, because that's another aspect of your paper that I thought was really interesting was bringing that point out, because I think oftentimes winning or sport philosophers seem embarrassed sometimes to talk about the value of winning on its own terms, and they feel like they need to put it into some other context, either that it's something that connects into broader life skills, or that it's that it's a necessary factor, but they don't want to call attention to just the very just fact of the value of playing to win and winning. Within certain moral constraints, of course, right? There are, as you say, unworthy victories, but that does beg then for, well, what is the standard here? And so this sort of mutual foundations of playing to win as well as the rules of the game, this sort of classic distinction between the sort of formalism of, well, it's totally defined by the rules versus this sort of internalism or ethos kind of argument that there's something else here, although what that something else is often kind of amorphous, but that they're both of those seem to be pulling at poles, and that there's something in between that's probably the more correct answer in terms of how we're going to understand a sport. Because it just doesn't seem like it can't just be the rules, right? For all the criticisms of formalism that you talk about as well as others. Go ahead.
No, I agree with that. I'm certainly not a formalist. I suppose one way to understand maybe that part of the paper in which I try to defend the claim that winning has independent value. It's a constitutive end of the enterprise. And I agree with your observation. It was striking to me when I turned to this literature for the first time. I think you put it very nicely. There's almost a sort of embarrassment mm-hmm. about the pursuit of winning. I acknowledge that I think we overvalue winning and we distort the value of winning, but I don't think that the right response is to utterly subordinate the value of winning to the value of skillful play or play that respects the rules. So maybe one way of understanding or situating the position that I'm trying to articulate is, it's certainly not a formalist position. Maybe I'm trying to contribute to the internalist position in saying that, look, part of what's in that ethos must be a commitment to playing to win. That's part of what forms the ethos of any competitive enterprise. And I wonder whether other internalists have really done that. Most of them, my impression is that most of them attempt to tie the value of winning to other ethical values. So I don't know. That was maybe a roundabout way of weighing in on that question.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Well, I said it, and then you said that I was right. Now I'm saying you're right for saying I'm right. But so we're congratulating each other. But there's something there that I think is worth pulling on, a thread that's worth pulling on in terms of just what is the value of winning in itself that sort of has some independent foundation there. What is the standard that we can appeal to? And I think that's a thread that you start to pull on, and you give something of an answer there in terms of connecting it into the competitor's project and so on. And I think that's certainly a part of it, but I think it's something that is worth pulling on even more and to bring out even more as a part of the conception of sport, because it's certainly going back to sort of what we talked about a little bit in the beginning. When we talk about the sort of practitioner, the people who play the games, who aren't philosophers, how do they think about it? And the importance of playing to win is something that I think is central to their conception of sport. And so I think it's something that we have to take into account and give some, and if we're going to downplay it, I think we need to say more about why we're going to downplay it. Although I don't think we should. I mean, I think it's actually something that we need to say more about and flesh out. And I think there is something to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I wanted to return for a moment. You mentioned the question about whether or not Suarez's play was honorable, whether it was the most honorable thing to do. I mean, I wonder what you think of this. If you're talking about Suarez's character, one way maybe to raise the question of whether or not the play was honorable, it would be to think about Suarez's character in light of the play. Mm-hmm. Now, if Suarez had come off the pitch afterwards and said, you know, that's not the kind of play that I like to resort to. But this was a situation in which we're talking about the World Cup. We're talking about playing for my nation. I'm not regretful or guilty about what I did, because I think it's you know, I shouldn't be blamed for it. But I do also acknowledge that by and large, these are not the kinds of plays that one just resorts to lightly or easily. One certainly doesn't look for opportunities to make these kinds of plays,
right,
in order to enhance one's competitive advantage. All of that would, again, if we want to talk about Suarez's character, all of that would speak in favor of that kind of play being consistent with an honorable athlete. I think you would agree.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The fact that he didn't, you know, casts a different sort of light on the play itself. And in as much as you're approaching it from the perspective, I think, of a virtue ethicist, and you want to think about not merely the act taken in isolation, but the character that produced the act, then that all taken together, I think, shows poorly on Suarez. And of course, by now, as I say in a footnote in the paper, you know, you can be a casual fan of football to know that Suarez has plenty counting against his character by this point.
Right. I mean, this wasn't like Steven Gerrard or Landon Donovan or someone like that committing this, which I think would have made it a little different. But actually, in some ways, I think it's better that it was someone like Suarez, because it's less easy to excuse it just based on the character of the person, and I think
Agreed.
we have to look more to other features. Whereas it's someone who normally has, you know, this noble character that we look up to in a lot of ways, or we think is really, you know, a good person, all things considered. It makes it easy to say, okay, well, maybe this is a lapse in judgment. So we can come up with some other story without really looking at the issue. And so, the
Right.
fact that Suarez has these other strikes against him, I think makes it so that we really have to look at the issue if we want to try to excuse it or even possibly justify it.
That's right. I mean, on my account, one of the crucial questions there is examining whether or not, and the extent to which there was a genuine conflict between the obligation to play to win and the obligation to play within the rules,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not the individual in question was responding to that conflict, or whether or not the individual in question will in fact circumvent the rules at, you know, whenever he can.
Right. Yeah, and I think that calls out to a very important issue in life, right?
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Well, we're pretty much out of time. Did you have any last thoughts or comments on it, on this, on anything else that you wanted to bring out?
Well, certainly, I want to thank you for reaching out to me to talk about this issue. I love thinking about it and talking about it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
The whole issue. Do it again. Do it again sometime. We just started touching on it at the end, but this whole issue of the basic definition of sport and how to figure the value of winning in light of it, I just wanted to, you know, second what you said, that I think it deserves more investigation. And I certainly don't think that I did anything close to settling the issue in the paper, but I hope that I raised enough issues to maybe make it more plausible to think that winning has an independent value that's just conferred by the context of competition itself. It doesn't need a further grounding beyond that context.
Good, yeah, and so I'm looking forward to the further development of that idea. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Sean.
This has been the Sports Ethics Podcast. You can find us at sportsethicist.com, Facebook, and Twitter. You can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.